Support comes from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture. They inspire, entertain, and educate through art, cultural, and educational programs and events. Join them to celebrate Juneteenth 2024. It's a new day. Learn more at AmistadCenter.org.
My name is Adrienne Joy Burns. I describe myself as a public historian and a digger. So we're sitting in the New Haven Museum. That's what it's called now. When it was founded in the 1880s, it was the New Haven Colony Society. All of these historical societies are founded across New England, across the state of Connecticut, to uplift the stories of the white people who came here first supposedly, and founded the colonies. And that eclipses indigenous history, that eclipses the history of how any people of African descent came here, whether they came here voluntarily or involuntarily. The descendants and the ancestors were very good at erasing pieces of history that they didn't want us to know about, or at least putting it in back shelves and closets and trunks in locked spaces where we didn't have a lot of access to it. How do we learn about the enslaved people if we don't look for them? And some of the evidence is still in the ground.
Can we look at some of the documents?
Oh yeah, we had them pulled just for you.
From Connecticut Public, this is Unforgotten, Connecticut's Hidden History of Slavery. I'm Diane Orson.
And I'm Frank Mitchell.
When we think of slavery in the U.S., we don't often think of the North.
Enslavement happened here and has deep roots in Connecticut and across New England.
In this series, we'll hear stories about recovering this history.
And we talk about some of the issues in and around these stories.
This story introduces us to researchers and historians who talk about Connecticut's hidden history. But first, Frank, I want to get straight to the big question in this room. You work in visual arts and public humanities. You're focused on histories that have been long ignored by cultural institutions and civic spaces. And in doing that, you've devoted a lot of your life to helping people hold uncomfortable conversations. And I'd like to begin one right now. Who owns this history? Who gets to claim this history? Who should present it? I just want to say that I'm a woman of Russian, Polish, and Jewish heritage, but I'm also a reporter on these stories. Can we talk about this?
Yes, let's try. Certainly, there is this legacy of appropriation. Lots of people have anxiety around who owns history because of what seems to have been lost or what truly was lost. During enslavement and in the years after, around culture and music and identity. And those feelings are real. History is shared. It's not history unless we all claim it and work through it. So I certainly believe that we all have to embrace this history and acknowledge it and recognize it. And everybody has their piece. We all show up in it. It is American history. And it takes all of us investing in it for it to actually give us what we need to move forward into the future.
You know, there's two things that I'd like to add to this. First, my hope is that this series offers a space to open up conversation and open up a closet that in many ways, for many of us, was closed for many years, and to look inside and see what's been there all along. And I hope that this series can join other efforts to help bring forward our story of Connecticut that we long have ignored. The other thing I just want to mention is I stumbled into this through music. In my other professional life, I'm a musician, a violinist, and I was invited to perform a couple of years ago at a church in Essex, and we were told that we were going to play music by a formerly enslaved composer who lived there. And we're going to learn more about that composer in one of our later segments. But the story blew my mind. I mean, I'd grown up in New England, in Rhode Island, and I walked the streets and I went to schools surrounded by names and places that I now know are all linked to New England's complicity in this history. Mm. And I never knew. I mean, I had zero understanding of this. And I wanted to learn more. And music opened the door for me. And that's where this story begins for me.
It's such a great aha moment. When we think about it, so much of this history is right in front of us. And buildings that were built in the 1700s that used free and enslaved Black labor and are still standing in New Haven. Music that is found in archives that people haven't touched in hundreds of years. All these relics are around us. And if we think about it, of course, some of them had to be used and made by free and sometimes enslaved Black people who were in Connecticut hundreds of years ago. Those folks were doing things all around what became the United States. There's no reason why they wouldn't have been here and in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts and in New York doing the same kind of work. And part of the job is to just remind people that, yes, these folks were here and they were doing these things. And if you see something that looks like it was made 200 years ago, it might well have been made by a person, a free or enslaved Black person who was in this country, in this region at that time.
So, Frank, were you surprised when we contacted you to work on this series, and why did you want to do it?
I wasn't really surprised. I feel like we are always bumping into these stories. Someone is always retrieving stories and thinking about what's been missing from the public account of Connecticut's history. And I think back to the bicentennial in 1976, when so many of these stories had this great prompt. And as we approach the 250th, it seems like there are lots of folks thinking about who's missing from the stories we tell about Connecticut. So I was glad to have this chance to visit some familiar stories and to be inspired by some new stories that I hadn't heard before. Thanks for the invite.
Thanks for coming on board. And let's listen now to our first story, then we'll talk some more. There's a deeply rooted perception that the North was home to the good guys, the abolitionists. The truth is far different. Slavery existed across colonial Connecticut. Enslaving people was legal here for more than 200 years and did not officially end until 1848. Let's meet several people shedding light on this history and why it matters.
My name is Adrienne Joy Burns. I describe myself as a public historian and a digger, one of those folks who's very fascinated by family genealogy and finding out more about the ancestors.
Adrienne Joy Burns spends a lot of time digging through historic wills, court documents, and church records. She remembers coming across a probate inventory from 1680 for the builder of a home in New Haven.
And on the probate inventory, it mentions things like 3 cows, 5 horses, 2 barns, 1 enslaved Negro woman, and 1 Indian boy. And so that's experiencing cognitive dissonance. People as property in a probate inventory? And the answer to that is enslaved people were considered property, like a cow or a horse.
Burns says we get a very abridged history in school.
They tell us about the famous people. They tell us about the founders. They don't tell us that 20 men, Black men from New Haven, went and fought in the American Revolution. There's no monument in this city that tells you that. So I went in search of Black history, and that led me to the story of enslavement in New England.
It's a story that's not easy to find. In the U.S., we tend to think of slavery as a Southern thing. There are very few reminders around us that enslaved Africans and also enslaved indigenous people helped build our New England states. Akia DeMaros Gomes is senior curator of Maritime Social Histories at the Mystic Seaport Museum. She puts it this way.
Slavery in New England has been intentionally erased, the history of slavery in New England. The story we tell is this is family slavery. This person was a member of the family. They helped to support the household. So it comes off as very benign and not dehumanizing, when in fact it was violent and dehumanizing.
I turned to Elizabeth Norman for the history lesson we never got in school. She's founding publisher of Connecticut Explored, the magazine of Connecticut history.
Let's start back at the beginning. Let's start where most people might think about the beginning of Connecticut. What would you imagine in your mind Connecticut looked like at that time? And I'm going to tell you, it's not what you think it was. When in the early 1600s, the first European explorers and then settlers arrived in Connecticut, though it didn't have that name and it didn't have any boundaries, what was here, in fact, was a thriving civilization of tens of thousands of people with a 10,000-year history.
Which helps to explain why the founding of Connecticut began with such conflict, violence, and war, after which there was a lot of work to do.
Clearing those forests, building farms, ships for transportation, etc. So there was a labor shortage. Meanwhile, the English and French colonies in the Caribbean had introduced slavery of Africans.
While here in Connecticut, settlers began to force indigenous people into slavery.
At the end of the Pequot War in 1637, the captured Pequots were enslaved as war prizes and traded in the West Indies for enslaved Africans and brought back to Connecticut. So that's probably around the time the first Africans, enslaved Africans, end up in the colony.
And slavery took hold, Kia DeBarros Gomes says.
There were enslaved men on ships. There were enslaved women and girls working in households. There were enslaved men building roads. It was everywhere.
The colonies established what became known as the Triangle Trade, from the Caribbean to New England to Africa, molasses to rum to enslaved people.
If you think about the triangle that New England was involved in, the Caribbean was a really important center. That is where the sugarcane would be cut and the molasses would be created. The distilleries were in places like Newport, New Haven, New London, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And then that rum that was produced would often, in fact, be used to trade for slaves on the African continent.
Not all Africans in colonial Connecticut were enslaved, but there were very few free black residents. Slavery in the state grew through the 1700s, peaking around the time of the Revolutionary War. In 1784, Connecticut passed a Gradual Emancipation Act and was the last of the New England states to end slavery.
Slavery didn't legally end in the state of Connecticut until 1848, some would say the eve of the Civil War.
Several efforts are underway now to recover this hidden history. John Mills of the Alex Brienne Corporation began researching lives of the enslaved as a way to reclaim his own family's story.
It's powerful. Oh my goodness, it's so powerful. It's a deeply prideful thing. And I don't know if that's a common thought that a person digging into their life and finding enslaved people would be so prideful, but it is for me.
These are stories of persistence, Mills says, and the history opens doors to a better understanding of our world today. But DeBarros Gomes says we have to change the way we tell it.
My hope is that by reframing narratives, by validating and honoring Indigenous and Black perspectives, that people come to see history as complex, right? It's not a story of hero and villains. It's a story of systems. Slavery was a system.
And Connecticut was part of that system. Talking about this strengthens everyone, says Adrian Joy Burns.
If a young person were to say to me, was this history my fault? The answer to that question is, no, it was not your fault. It's not associated with you. It neither makes you a good or a bad person. Learning about this history is something that's going to be a benefit to you because it helps us to understand how we got here. And that's the important part, because that's what we can change. We can change it when we understand it.
That is the hope, and there's a lot there. I really appreciate IKEA reminding us that this history is complex, and there are so many opportunities to share it, lift it up, and push it out into places where it hasn't been before. And certainly part of that challenge is working through exhibitions and books and school programs, but we probably need to do more. Hopefully, we'll begin to think about what else goes beyond sort of this first round of places where this history is often missing and needs to be seen, whether it's in places in popular culture where it's not normally seen. Every movie you've ever seen that talks about or references slavery in the South. And any dream sequence about it is in the South. There's not, even for something like Scorsese's Gangs of New York, where we see Black people in New York around the time of the Civil War, nobody thinks, oh, they probably were enslaved here and gained their freedom in New York. And so the opportunities to remind people in the broader culture about this history are there for us. And as Akia says, it's complex. There's a lot of work to be done. And some of that really is pushing out into those places that where slavery seems to be something that happens only in the South.
That's interesting. You work in public humanities, and you're an editorial consultant for this project. Talk to me a little bit about the role that different people play in doing this kind of work. What kinds of expertise can people bring to this type of research and work?
Yeah, there's so many important opportunities in uncovering this history and sharing it. And as Joy Burns says, being a digger is critically important. Being a public historian is important. It's important to be a curator. Being an expert, and being an expert either on your family history or being a professional expert, is critical. And it's really heartening to see how many folks are doing this work in so many different places. And I think what this series seems to remind us is that there's a role for everybody, whether you're a high school student or a church organist or a museum curator or a history teacher in a high school or an academic historian or a magazine publisher. Some part of this story can touch you and inspire you, and you can get out there and do it. And there are lots of great reminders of folks doing that work around Connecticut, and it is inspiring.
So I'm also interested to know, I was saying earlier, I'm from Rhode Island. Are you from New England? Was there discussion of slavery in the North in your family?
I grew up in Ohio. My parents are from Connecticut. They actually got married in Hartford, and they were headed to a honeymoon in California. They were driving, and they had, my father had a great aunt in Cleveland, and they stopped to see her. And Cleveland apparently was so compelling that they all just stayed. And soon people from Hartford sold their home on Tower Avenue, my mother's parents, and moved to Cleveland as well. And her sisters did as so. We all grew up in Cleveland, which was kind of amazing. And we did hear stories about Connecticut. We didn't hear stories about ancestors who fought in the Civil War. So they didn't go that far back, but we definitely heard stories about Connecticut. And it really was this kind of idyllic place for us. So we only got the good stories. We didn't get the difficult stories, though my mother and her sisters knew people who were doing important work around civil rights and justice and equity in Hartford. And they did mention them occasionally.
And what led you to the kind of work you do? You, for many years, led the Amistad Museum.
In undergrad, got to do lots of great programming. And at a certain point, I realized it was easier to teach from objects than it was to just get up and lecture, and spend a lot of time in museums around DC and New York, kind of proving that to myself, that talking an audience or a group through an exhibition where you could point to objects and talk about their significance gave people an opening and space to imagine something that was much harder for them to do in a classroom when you were standing behind a lectern and kind of telling them facts that they clearly didn't want to believe or could find reasons to dispute. And that's sort of what has led me to do a lot of digging, as Joy Burns calls it, and thinking about history in Connecticut and sort of tracking things down and looking for objects that help to tell those stories, because it does feel like having those objects, it's a great prompt to begin a discussion about what could have been and what did happen, and those things make the conversation easier in a lot of cases.
The title of our series is Unforgotten, Connecticut's Hidden History of Slavery. Would you agree that the story is hidden?
I always wrestle with that. It certainly has been obscured, but I don't know that I'd call it hidden. I think in every town history, or many of the town histories that you touch from the late 19th century, there is a chapter on, in their parlance, Indians and slavery. And they do go through and talk about who lived there and who was enslaved to whom. And an episode of indigenous history from Cornwall or New Haven or Brantford or Hartford County. So those stories have been there. And if you're looking for them, they're definitely out there. And so it feels like saying hidden history makes it feel as though it wasn't always there, and it really was.
It was there, but many of us didn't see it. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. There's so many really interesting questions about how Connecticut's history is shaped and how the state changes and how our perceptions change. It's probably for another podcast. It would be great to do that. But I am curious about how we become sort of a more suburban state, having had so many places where people did industrial jobs outside of the cities, how we lost these stories around enslavement and indigenous history, even though they were there. Mm. And clearly there's something that's happening in the early 20th century in which we're telling ourselves a different kind of story. And obviously a big part of that is we didn't invest in the kinds of monuments and highway markers and public infrastructure that would remind us of this history and make it part of daily life. And hopefully that's something we can change.
Next time on Unforgotten.
We all have lives. We all came from somewhere. We all own this country. We all built it. It's just that some of us have been left out. And the history that we've learned is only one small slice of the pie that makes America great.
Thanks for listening. I'm reporter-producer Diane Orson. Frank Mitchell is our consulting editor. Eric Austin is our executive editor. The senior director of storytelling is Katie Tolarski, and Cassandra Basler is our podcast producer. Editing help from Patrick Scahill, Erica McIntosh, and Meg Dalton. Special thanks to Julianne Veracci, senior director of visuals. A big shout out to our social, visuals, and marketing teams for their support. Vanessa De La Torre is our chief content officer. Our theme music is The Pleasures of Solitude from a manuscript with compositions by Sonny Freeman. Visit ctpublic.org/unforgotten to learn more about the project, including more photos and videos. Unforgotten is a production of Connecticut Public.